zoning excess amounts of land sign recordable contracts in which they promise to sell such lands within a designated period at prices reflecting the land's pre-project worth. But the contracts were to be signed with the local irrigation district acting as wholesaler of the Bureau's water, not with the Bureau itself. It was an ideal opportunity to camouflage acreage violations, since the same people who were in violation of the Reclamation Act often sat on the local irrigation district's board of directors. A more important and insidious reason, however, had to do with the nature of the Bureau itself. There was a tendency for some engineers to view public works as ends in themselves, admits Michael Robinson. Despite official declarations from more sensitive administrators that reclamation is measured not in engineering units, but in homes and agricultural values, the service regarded itself as an engineering outfit. That may have been the understatement of the year. To build a great dam on a tempestuous river like the Snake was terrifically exhilarating work. Enforcing a hodgepodge of social ideals was hardly that. Stopping a wild river was a straightforward job, subjugable to logic, and the result was concrete, heroic, real, a dam. Enforcing repayment obligations and worrying about speculators and excess landowners was a cumbersome, troublesome, time-consuming nuisance, a nuisance without reward. Was the Bureau to abandon the most spellbinding effort of modern times, transforming the desert into a garden, just because a few big landowners were taking advantage of the program? Just because some farmers couldn't pay as much as Congress hoped? There were to be still more reforms tacked on to the Reclamation Act, reforms extending the repayment period to 50 years, setting water prices according to the farmer's ability to pay, using hydroelectric revenues to subsidize irrigation costs. It wasn't until the 1930s, however, that the reclamation program went into high gear. In the 1920s and early 1930s, the nation's nexus of political power still lay east of the Mississippi River. The West simply didn't have the votes to authorize a dozen big water projects each year. Western politicians who were to exercise near despotic rule over the Bureau's authorizing committee in later years, men like Wayne Aspinall and Bernie Sisk and Carl Hayden, were still working their way up the political ranks. In 1902, the year the reclamation program began, Arizona was still 10 years away from becoming a state. Presidents Harding and Coolidge were ideological conservatives from the East who sternly resisted governmental involvements in economic affairs, unless it was an opportunity for their friends to earn a little graft. And even Herbert Hoover, though a Californian and an engineer, was not regarded by the Western water lobby and the Bureau as a particularly loyal friend. All of this was to change more abruptly than the Bureau of Reclamation and its growing dependency could have hoped. The most auspicious event in its entire history was the election to the presidency in 1932 of a freewheeling, free-spending patrician. The second most auspicious event was the passage, during the five-term Roosevelt-Truman interregnum, of several omnibus river basin bills that authorized not one, not five, not even 10, but dozens of dams and irrigation projects at a single stroke. Economics mattered little, if at all. If the irrigation venture slid into an ocean of debt, the huge hydroelectric dams authorized within the same river basin could generate the necessary revenues to bail them out, or so it was thought. It was a breathtakingly audacious solution to an intractable problem, and the results were to be breathtaking as well. Between Franklin Roosevelt and the river basin approach, which in an instant could authorize dams and canals and irrigation projects from headwaters to river mouth across 1,000 miles of terrain, the natural landscape of the American West, the rivers and deserts and wetlands and canyons, was to undergo a man-made transformation the likes of which no desert civilization has ever seen. The first, and perhaps the most fateful such transformation, was wrought in the most arid and hostile quarter of the American West, a huge desert basin transected by one comparatively miniature river, the Colorado. Chapter 4 An American Nile 1 Ours was the first and will doubtless be the last party of whites to visit this profitless locale. Lieutenant Joseph Christmas Ives, on sailing up the Colorado River to a point near the present location of Las Vegas in 1857. The Colorado is neither the biggest nor the longest river in the American West, nor, except for certain sections described in 19th-century journals as awful or appalling, is it the most scenic. Its impressiveness and importance have to do with other things. It is one of the siltiest rivers in the world. The Virgin Colorado could carry sediment loads close to those of the much larger Mississippi, and one of the wildest. Its drop of nearly 13,000 feet is unequaled in North America, and its constipation-relieving rapids, before dams tamed its flash floods, could have flipped a small freighter. The Colorado's modern notoriety, however, stems not from its wild rapids and plunging canyons, but from the fact that it is the most legislated, most debated, and most litigated river in the entire world. It also has more people, more industry, and a more significant economy dependent on it than any comparable river in the world. If the Colorado River suddenly stopped flowing, you would have 4 years of carryover capacity in the reservoirs before you had to evacuate most of Southern California and Arizona and a good portion of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The river system provides over half the water of Greater Los Angeles, San Diego, and Phoenix. It grows much of America's domestic production of fresh winter vegetables. It illuminates the neon city of Las Vegas, whose annual income is one-fourth the entire gross national product of Egypt, the only other place on earth where so many people are so helplessly dependent on one river's flow. The greater portion of the Nile, however, still manages, despite many diversions, to reach its delta at the Mediterranean Sea. The Colorado is so used up on its way to the sea that only a burbling trickle reaches its dried-up delta at the head of the Gulf of California, and then only in wet years. To some conservationists, the Colorado River is the preeminent symbol of everything mankind has done wrong, a harbinger of a squalid and deserved fate. To its preeminent impounder, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, it is the perfection of an ideal. The Colorado has a significance that goes beyond mere prominence. It was on this river that the first of the world's truly great dams was built, a dam which gave engineers the confidence to dam the Columbia, the Volga, the Paraná, the Niger, the Nile, the Zambezi, and most of the world's great rivers. The dam rose up at the depths of the Depression and carried America's spirits with it. Its electricity helped produce the ships and planes that won the Second World War, and its water helped grow the food. From such illustrious and hopeful beginnings, however, the tale of human intervention in the Colorado River degenerates into a chronicle of hubris and obtuseness. Today, even though the Colorado still resembles a river only in its upper reaches and its Grand Canyon stretch, even as hydrologists amuse themselves by speculating about how many times each molecule of water has passed through pairs of kidneys, it is still unable to satisfy all the demands on it, so it is referred to as a deficit river, as if the river were somehow at fault for its overuse. And though there are plans to relieve the deficit, plans to import water from as far away as Alaska, the 20 million people in the Colorado Basin will probably find themselves facing chronic shortages, if not some kind of a catastrophe, before any of these grandiose schemes is built, if indeed one is ever built. One could almost say, then, that the history of the Colorado River contains a metaphor for our time. One could say that the age of great expectations was inaugurated at Hoover Dam, a 50-year flowering of hopes when all things appeared possible. And one could say that amid the salt-encrusted sands of the river's dried-up delta, we began to founder on the era of limits. In terms of annual flow, the Colorado isn't a big river. In the United States, it does not even rank among the top 25. But like a 40-pound wolverine that can drive a bear off its dinner, it is unrivaled for sheer orneriness. The Virgin Colorado is tempestuous, willful, headstrong. Its flow varied psychotically between a few thousand cubic feet per second and a couple of hundred thousand, sometimes within a few days. Draining a vast, barren watershed whose rains usually come in deluges, its sediment volume was phenomenal. If the river, running high, were diverted through an ocean liner with a cheesecloth strainer at one end, it would have filled the ship with mud in an afternoon. The silt would begin to settle about 200 miles above the Gulf of California, below the last of the Grand Canyon's rapids, where the river's gradient finally moderated for good. There was so much silt that it raised the entire riverbed foot by foot, year by year, until the Colorado slipped out of its loose confinement of low sandy bluffs and tore off in some other direction, instantly digging a new course. It developed an affection for several such channels, returning to them again and again: Bee River, New River, Alamo River, big braided washes that sat dry and expectant in the desert, waiting for the river to return. The New and Alamo channels drove into Mexico, then veered back north into the United States, 100-mile semi-loop, and ended at the foot of the Chocolate Mountains, where the delinquent river would form a huge evanescent body of water called the Salton Sea. After a while, the New and Alamo channels would themselves silt up, and the Colorado would throw itself back into its old bed and return to the Gulf of California, much to the relief of the great schools of shrimp, the clouds of waterfowl, and the thousands of cougars, jaguars, and bobcats that prowled its delta. The Salton Sea would slowly evaporate, and life would return to normal, for a while. The river went on such errant flings every few dozen years, a vanishing moment in geologic time, but long enough so that the first people who tried to tame it had no idea what they were in for. The first of these tamers was an eastern developer with a grandiose imagination, a bulldog chin, a shock of steel-wool hair, and a name suggestive of his temperament. In 1892, Charles Rockwood saw the Colorado River for the first time and became obsessed. Sitting north of it, an appendage of the vast Sonoran Desert of Southern California and Arizona, were hundreds of thousands of absolutely flat acres built by its ancient delta, fertile land where you could grow crops 12 months of the year. All that stood in the way of cultivation was an annual rainfall of 2.4 inches, about the lowest in the United States. Despite the imposing nature of the task, the temptation to play God with the river and turn this brutal desert green was too much for Rockwood to resist. After traveling halfway around the world for financial support, he seduced the most famous private irrigationist of his day, George Chaffee, into joining forces with him. By 1901, Rockwood and Chaffee had cut a diversion channel, and a good portion of the river was pouring over fields in what had once been called the Valley of the Dead. In grand 19th-century fustian tradition, Rockwood named it Imperial Valley. Within 8 months, there were 2 towns, 2,000 settlers, and 100,000 acres ready for harvesting. By 1904, however, the artificial channel had already silted up, and a bypass had to be cut. It silted up. Another bypass was cut. It, too, silted up. Finally, after much negotiation, the developers persuaded the Mexican government to let them cut still another channel below the border. Because it was meant as a temporary expedient, while the original channel was cleaned out in advance of the spring floods, the Mexican channel had the flimsiest of control gates. As luck would have it, the spring floods arrived nearly 2 months early. In February, a great surge of snowmelt and warm rain spilled out of the Gila River, just above the Mexican channel, and made off with the control gate. For the first time in centuries, the river was back in its phantom channel, the Alamo River, heading for its old haunt, the Salton Sink. As the surge advanced across the Imperial Valley, it cut into the loamy soil at a foot-per-second rate, forming a waterfall that marched backward toward the main channel. Even as their fields were being eaten, and as their homes swam away, the valley people came out by the hundreds to see this apparition, a 20-foot falls moving backward at a slow walk. By summer, virtually all of the Colorado River was out of its main channel, and the Salton Sink had once again become the Salton Sea. Chaffee had had some differences with Rockwood and got out of the California Development Company a short while earlier with his reputation intact, leaving his erstwhile partner ruined. But the Southern Pacific Railroad had already invested too much money in a spur line to the valley to watch it abandoned to fate. So it took Rockwood's company into receivership and set about trying to tame the river. For the next 2 years, Edwin H. Harriman, the railroad magnate, and the Colorado River fought nose to nose. Southern Pacific trains crawled back and forth across the valley like caterpillars, carrying rock and gravel to plug the half-mile breach. But 1905, 1906, and 1907 were some of the wettest years in the Colorado Basin's history. In 1907, the river sent a record 25 million acre-feet, 8 quadrillion gallons, to the Gulf. The floods, one following another, casually ripped Harriman's brush weirs to shreds. His miles of driven piles were uprooted and washed away. Finally, in February of 1907, after laughing away the railroad's best efforts, the river decided to lull. With mad energy, the SP crews finally secured the breach. When the next surge came down, the weirs held, and the river, dumping silt 10 times faster than the trains, began rebuilding its own confinement. Victory or no, the Colorado River was a rampant horse in a balsa corral. The only way to control it effectively, and to give the farmers some insurance against its countervailing tendency to dry up, was to build a dam, a huge dam, to lop the peaks off the floods and provide storage during droughts. The problem with such a dam, from the point of view of the basin at large, was that California was then the only state in a position to use the water. Wyoming, Arizona, Nevada, and New Mexico were still mostly uninhabited. Colorado and Utah had a few 100,000 people each, but they had scarcely begun to tap the Colorado River and its tributaries. Most of Utah's irrigation had been developed in another basin. California, on the other hand, was gaining people like no place on earth, and most of the growth was occurring in the south. The Imperial Valley could have immediately used 3 or 4 million acre-feet of the river, the consumption of all the upper basin states and then some. The Coachella Valley, farther north, and the Palo Verde and Yuma projects could swallow another 1 million acre-feet. Los Angeles, growing like a gourd in the night, would soon overrun its Owens Valley supply. The next logical source of water, the only logical source, was the Colorado River. Under simple appropriative rights doctrine, the water would belong to California as soon as it began to use it. If California perfected its rights in court, it would, in effect, monopolize a huge portion of the river for itself. And the real injustice in all of this was that California contributed nothing to the river's flow. Nearly half the runoff came from Colorado and another third from Wyoming and Utah. Arizona and New Mexico contributed very little. Nevada and California, nothing at all. California's efforts to get the dam authorized by Congress were soon beaten back. Finally, it realized that if it wanted the dam and a reliable share of the river, it would have to sit down with its neighbor states and divide it up. The negotiation of the Colorado River Compact took place in 1922 under the guidance of Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover at Bishop's Lodge, a swank resort outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. For the time spent debating and drafting it, about 11 months, and its reputation as a Western equivalent of the Constitution, the compact didn't settle much. Using the Reclamation Service's estimated average flow of 17.5 million annual acre-feet, the delegates from the seven states divided the river arbitrarily at Lee's Ferry, Arizona, a point just below the Utah border, into two artificial basins. California, Arizona, and Nevada were the lower basin. The other four states were the upper basin. Pieces of New Mexico and Arizona were in both. Each basin was allotted 7.5 million acre-feet. How they were to divide that among themselves was their problem. Of the remainder, 1.5 million acre-feet were reserved for Mexico, and the final million acre-feet were apportioned, with extreme reluctance on the part of some, as a bonus to the lower basin, whose delegates had threatened to walk out of the negotiations if they didn't get a better deal. The compact was signed by the delegates in November of 1922. They then took it home for ratification by the voters or legislatures of their respective states, which quickly tore it to shreds. California wouldn't ratify without a conjugal authorization of Boulder Canyon Dam and a new canal running exclusively through American territory to Imperial Valley, a demand that gave the upper basin fits. Arizona wanted to divide the lower basin's apportionment before it ratified anything. Harry Chandler, probably the most influential human being in Southwest, he talked through his vast wealth in his newspaper, was delighted by the compact and the authorization of the dam, but he was too greedy to tolerate an all-American canal, which would divert the river right above his 860,000 acres in Mexico, so he ended up opposing everything. George Maxwell, the head of the National Reclamation Association, should have been in favor of Boulder Dam, but out of principle he opposed anything Harry Chandler liked. In 1928, after 6 years of paralysis, Congress took matters into its own hands. It authorized Boulder Dam and the All-American Canal on the condition that at least six of the seven states ratify the compact and that California limit its annual diversion to 4.4 million acre-feet per year. That implied only 2.8 million for Arizona. Nevada got 300,000 acre-feet, which was less than it wanted. Arizona, as a result, became the one state that refused to ratify, an act of defiance that would muddle things for another 35 years. At the time, however, its vote wasn't needed, and the other state's ratification led forthwith to the California Limitation Act and, subsequently, to passage of the Boulder Canyon Project Act. All of this appeared to settle matters. The basin could now embark on an orgy of growth the likes of which the West had never seen. And it did settle things, temporarily at least, except for one small matter. The average annual flow of the Colorado River was nowhere near 17.5 million acre-feet. In 1930, the American West had a population of 11 million people, about the population of New York State. Half of the people were in California, by far the most populous and modern of the Western states. When Californians traveled, however, they went mainly on dirt roads. The drive from San Francisco to Lake Tahoe, which is now done in 3 or 4 hours, was a two-day adventure or ordeal, depending on one's point of view. The city's great bridges had not yet been built. San Jose was not yet a city of 30,000, Silicon Valley a stronghold of orchards and roaming mountain lions. In some of the other states, the usual means of locomotion was still a horse and wagon. Electricity and telephones were unknown in most rural communities and didn't reach the remote ones until the 1950s. In the midst of the same depopulated, untrammeled region, however, the engineering wonder of all time was about to rise. In Oakland, California, an egomaniacal small-time construction tycoon named Henry J. Kaiser had followed the passage of the Boulder Canyon Project Act with consuming interest. Obsessed with his niche in history, Kaiser was still enough of a realist to know that he could not begin to build such a dam alone. So he called up his friend W.A. Bechtel to ask if he was interested in making a joint bid. Dad Bechtel was a horse-drawn Fresno scraper kind of contractor. Most of his business was road paving, his most noteworthy innovation, a folding toothbrush which he carried on trips. Outside of Northern California, and even there, the Bechtel Corporation was all but unknown. "I don't know, Henry," was Bechtel's response when Kaiser, flushed with excitement, got him on the phone. It sounds a little ambitious to me. 1,000 miles away in Utah, the two sheep-ranching Mormon brothers named W.H. and E.O. Wattis were as captivated by the Boulder Canyon project as Kaiser, and just as unable to undertake it themselves. The Wattis' other business, the Utah Construction Company, specialized in something as mundane as Bechtel's paving contracts, laying railroad bed. Lately, however, they had taken on a new partner, a maverick Mormon banker with Keynesian leanings who talked about deficit financing while candidate Franklin Roosevelt was still promising a balanced budget. His name was Mariner Eccles, and the reward he was about to receive for his ideological flexibility was an influential position on the Federal Reserve Board. The Wattises had also been in contact with Harry Morrison and Morris Knutson, two engineers formerly with the Bureau of Reclamation who had gone into business together in Boise, Idaho. And they had spoken with Frank Crow, another former Bureau engineer whose enthusiasm for Boulder Dam was as obsessive as Kaiser's. Morrison had just returned from a trip east, where he had tried to influence the financial community to back a bid on the dam. He was told by the Western bankers that there wasn't a company west of the Mississippi they would trust to take on something like this. But one thing would lead to another. Before long, the Wattises were talking with Bechtel and Kaiser, and Henry and Dad were in touch with some other firms, J.F. Shea Construction of Los Angeles, McDonald and Kahn of San Francisco, General Construction of Seattle. In February of 1931, during a meeting at the Engineers Club in San Francisco, the first of the West's super companies was born. There were 8 firms altogether, but Kaiser couldn't resist borrowing a name from the tribunal before which the Tongs, the Chinese equivalent of the mafia families, took their grievances. At his insistence, the executives agreed to call their joint venture Six Companies, Inc. Hawking everything but their shirts, they could barely scrape together the few million dollars they would need to buy enough equipment to begin the job. When the Bureau auctioned off the job, however, it was Six Companies' amazingly low bid, in the amount of $48,890,995.50, that won. Once again, sang the Los Angeles Times, the West had laughed at logic and driven its destiny over obstacles that rational minds deemed insuperable. The first 18 months of work on Boulder Canyon Dam involved the construction of a new Colorado River. 4 diversion tunnels were blasted through the rock of the Box Canyon, 2 on the Nevada side and 2 on the Arizona side, each of them 3/4 mile long. Their diameter was spacious enough to accommodate a jumbo jet shorn of its wings, a capacity that was needed mainly as insurance against an errant flood of 200,000 cubic feet per second or more. The task required the excavation of 3.5 million tons of rock with enough dynamite to level Toledo. On November 13, 1932, 4 tremendous explosions blew out the entrances and exits of the 2 Arizona tunnels. The dust had not yet settled when a caravan of trucks lumbered onto a trestle bridge built downstream from the tunnel entrances and began dumping rocks and earth in the river's path. Finding itself blockaded, the Colorado slowly roiled and rose in frustration. Sensing an escape route, it rode off into the tunnels. In a matter of hours, the river had been lured out of a bed it had occupied since the Grand Canyon was formed. No sooner was the Colorado flowing through the canyon walls than the crews began replacing the flimsy trestle dam with a far more substantial cofferdam. Then, for good measure, they built another below. Made of earth and rock and faced with concrete, the upper cofferdam measured 450 by 750 by 96 feet. Half a century earlier, it would have been the largest dam in the world, but its usefulness was to be measured in months. When the cofferdams were finished, the engineers turned to the next task, stripping the canyon abutments to expose fresh, clean, solid rock. Because the dam would rise more than 700 feet, there was no crane big enough to do the job. It would have to be done by hand. The 400 men whose job it was to clean the walls were known as high scalers. Those who persevered, 7 were killed on the job, spent months hanging 400 or 500 feet in the air, drilling holes in the rock, inserting dynamite, and praying they would be hauled to safety before it exploded. Because the canyon was so tight, they also had to blast out space for portions of the huge powerhouse, the intake towers, and the penstock headers. Some of the rock amphitheaters they created could have held an orchestra. Besides the hazards of the construction work, the falling rock, the explosives, electrocution, behemoth machines, besides the hazards of off-hours, fistfights, drunken binges, social diseases from the whores who camped about, besides all this, there was the heat. The low-lying parts of the Colorado and Sonora deserts are the hottest corner of North America, and we are speaking of temperatures in open, ambient air. The Colorado's Box Canyon held heat like an oven with the door open about an inch. Workers sometimes sacrificed eggs to see if they would actually fry on a sun-fired rock. The first death from heat prostration occurred a few days after construction began, and so many men collapsed that some of the crews finally forced a shutdown, demanded a pay raise, and ultimately staged a strike. The strike, however, did no good. Next to Boulder City was an encampment of tents and shanties known as Ragtown, where the unemployed waited by the hundreds for someone to give up, be fired, or die. One of the myths about the Depression, Arthur Miller, the playwright, once said, is that it brought everyone closer together. Actually, it just made everyone more voracious. "They will work under our conditions, or they will not work at all," proclaimed W. H. Wattis. And they did, at a base pay of $4 per day. It was in 1933 when the explosive din suddenly stopped and an eerie silence descended on Boulder Canyon. The canyon walls were finally clean, the abutments sculpted, the cofferdams in place. Nearly 3 years after work had begun, the dam was still a figment of the imagination. Now it was time to dig down to bedrock. The bed of the Mississippi is hundreds, even thousands of feet deep in silt. The Columbia and the Missouri flow over alluvial wash as thick as Arctic glaciers. On the Colorado, however, to everyone's amazement, bedrock was struck at 40 feet. A milled piece of saw timber was found resting at the bottom of the muck, obviously of very recent origin. Since white men had begun to settle the region, perhaps 80 years before, a huge flood had evidently washed the entire channel clean. No one seemed bothered by the certainty that all of the silt constantly being relocated along the entire 1,450-mile length of the river would be forever imprisoned behind Hoover and the other dams soon to be built. In June of 1933, the foundation was finally ready, and the first of the wooden forms that would be used to lay concrete was being built. The concrete, 66 million tons of it, created one of the most vexing problems the engineers had faced, a problem peculiar to large dams. The dam's size and weight would generate superpressures and insulating mass that would both generate and retain heat. Though the dam would appear solid, it would be in reality a pyramid of warm pudding. Left to its own devices, Boulder Dam would require 100 years to cool down. Moreover, the cooling would be uneven, and the resultant shrinkage and warping would leave the structure fissured and cracked. After weeks of wondering what to do, the engineers finally agreed on a solution. As each form was poured, 1-inch pipe would be laid through it at 5-foot intervals. Frigid water from a cooling plant would then be run through the pipes until convection cooling had lowered the temperature of the concrete to 43 degrees near the base and 72 degrees near the crest. Since the amount of pipe required, if it had been laid out in a straight line, would have reached to Big Sur on the Central California coast, this was no mean refrigeration plant. Converted to ice-making, it could have chilled a couple of million cocktails a day. Instead, it reduced a century of cooling time to something like 20 months. When visitors were led to the canyon rim to watch Boulder Dam on the rise, there was usually a long moment of silence, a moment when the visitors groped for something appropriate to say, something that expressed proper awe and reverence for the dazzling, half-formed monstrosity they saw. The dam defied description. It defied belief. Standing on the upstream side of it, two on each flank, were the intake towers, marvelous fluted concrete columns rising 395 feet from platforms that had been blasted halfway up the canyon walls. The towers were as high as 40-story buildings, and someone who had never been to New York or Chicago or Philadelphia would never have seen a man-made structure that high. But the crest of the dam rose nearly to the tops of the towers, and its foundation was hundreds of feet below their base. Its seamless curve swept across the canyon and embedded itself in each side, a gigantic but somehow graceful intrusion. The men working on top were not even ants. They hardly qualified as fleas. Stretching overhead, from canyon rim to canyon rim, was a thick cable on which hung suspended a 16-ton bucket that lowered fresh concrete into the forms. Although it was big enough to accommodate a Buick, the bucket seemed incapable of ever filling the dimensions of Hoover Dam, the name it was ultimately to acquire. But 24 hours per day, 220 cubic yards an hour, it did. After 2 years of pouring, the dam was finally topped out. On March 23, 1935, it stood 726 feet and 5 inches tall. When the engineers surveyed what they had built, it seemed impossible to believe that anything so immense could fail to hold back the Colorado River under every conceivable circumstance. Between 1907 and 1917, however, the wettest period on record, the river had discharged nearly enough water to fill a reservoir during several years. 24 million acre feet, 12 million, 25 and a half million, 14 million, 20 million, 19 million, 20 million. Hidden within the figures were big floods, periods when the river flowed at 100,000 or 200,000 cubic feet per second for weeks in a row. If such a flood happened to hit when the reservoir was full, the full force of it would have to be spilled. The penstocks leading to the power plant would never be able to handle it. But 200,000 cubic feet per second sent over the top of the dam could erode it like a seawall in a storm. The dam, therefore, required spillways on either side, and to allow for the unforeseen and the incredible, they were to be built to handle 400,000 cubic feet per second, nearly twice the Columbia River's flow. The spillway troughs were excavated on the canyon sides of the intake towers and led into the vast diversion tunnels hollowed through the walls. Like everything else about the dam, they were designed curvilinear and graceful, with immense brass drum gates shaped like diamond heads. Set down in a spillway channel, the Bismarck would have floated clear. Some of the project engineers wistfully suggested that turbines be installed at the spillway outlets, even if they operated only during floods. With the penstocks and the outlet works both generating power, the dam, during brief periods, could have electrified the state of California. Nothing, however, was more astonishing than the speed with which all of it was built. As the nation languished in the Depression, as plant after plant remained idle and company after company went bankrupt, Hoover Dam was being built at a breathtaking pace. The eyes of the country were fixed on it in awe. A landmark event, the completion of a spillway, the installation of the last generator, was front-page news. The initial excavations for the diversion tunnels had begun on May 16, 1931. The river was not detoured from its channel until November, and the cofferdams were not completed until April of 1933. But 2 years later, all the blocks in the dam were raised to crest elevation, and a year later everything was finished. Spillways, power plant, penstocks, generators, galleries, even the commemorative plaque in the frieze alongside U.S. Highway 93, which ran across the top. The first electrical power from what was then the largest power plant in the world was produced in the fall of 1936. The greatest structure on Earth, perhaps the most significant structure that has ever been built in the United States, had gone up in under 3 years. The difference in climate between the eastern and western United States, the fact that the east generally gets enough rainfall to support agriculture, while the west generally does not, is easily the most significant distinction between those two regions. It is also obvious that there are significant distinctions within each region as well. For example, oranges grow well in central Florida, they do not in South Carolina, a few hundred miles north. The climate in Duluth, Minnesota, is quite different from that in Chicago, a mere day's drive away. In the West, however, climatic differences far more striking than these may occur within the same state, even within the same county. In the Willamette Valley of Oregon, a farmer can raise a number of different crops without irrigation. There is usually a summer drought, but it is short, and even if he decides not to depend entirely on rainfall, a few inches of irrigation water, instead of the 100 inches used by some farmers in California and Arizona, will usually do. 2 hours away, on the east side of the Cascades, rainfall drops to a third of what the Willamette Valley ordinarily receives. Not only that, but the whole of eastern Oregon is much higher than the section west of the Cascades and lacks a marine influence, so the climate is far colder as well. It can be 40 above zero in Eugene and 10 below zero in Bend, a 2-hour drive to the east. In eastern Oregon, not only must the farmer irrigate, but he is extraordinarily limited compared to his Willamette Valley counterpart in the types of crops he can grow. Around Bakersfield, California, an irrigation farmer can raise the same crops that one sees growing in Libya, southern Italy, Hawaii, and Iraq. Pistachios, kiwis, almonds, grapes, olives, melons, crops whose value per cultivated acre is astonishingly high. An hour's drive away, across the Tehachapi Mountains, lies the Antelope Valley, a high desert region with a cold interior climate that can bring frost in May and where little but alfalfa and grass can be grown. Both Bakersfield and the Antelope Valley are within Kern County, whose climatic extremes are rather typical of California, and for that matter, of many counties throughout the West. Air conditioners and furnaces in two relatively nearby towns, Phoenix and Flagstaff, may be running at the same time. One end of a county may be plagued by floods, while another is plagued by drought. The reason for all this is mainly topographic. The mountains that block weather fronts and seal off the interior from the ocean summer cooling and winter warmth, the prevailing westerly winds of the northern hemisphere give the ocean a much wider influence in the west than in the east, reaching as far away as Idaho. The tectonic upheavals that pushed much of the interior west, even the flat mountainless sections, to elevations higher than a mile. The significance of it, from the standpoint of water development, is that it makes infinitely greater economic sense to build dams and irrigate in warmer regions than in colder ones, even if it makes infinitely greater political sense to do otherwise. When John Wesley Powell explored the American West, he duly noted these bewildering extremes of climate. Powell knew that irrigation was an expensive proposition, and that a few inches of extra rainfall or a couple of thousand feet of elevation difference would mean a project that was worth developing, or on the other hand, a project that would require heavy subsidization. A farmer raising fruit or 2 annual crops of tomatoes in the Imperial Valley might earn 10 times more per irrigated acre than a farmer raising alfalfa at 6,000 feet in Colorado. Yet it might cost far more to deliver water to the Colorado farmer because his water might have to be pumped uphill, out of deep river canyons, while the Imperial Valley lay near sea level below Hoover Dam. The Imperial Valley farmer could pay enough for water to allow the government to recoup its enormous investment in dams, canals, and other irrigation works. The Colorado farmer might be able to repay, at best, a dime on every dollar. What Powell did not foresee, however, was the Colorado River basin arbitrarily divided, with each half given an equal amount of water. To him, such a false partitioning might have seemed absurd, for it made far better sense to irrigate in the lower basin than in the upper. But he could not imagine that the blind ambition of the Bureau and the political power of the upper basin would join forces to try to pretend that a mile of elevation difference and the staggering climatic difference such a disparity implies did not exist. Simply stated, the problem with most of the upper basin was that it was too high, too dry, and too cold. Land that was well suited to irrigation in a topographic sense, meaning that a river flowed through a wide valley with good soil which lay below a natural dam site somewhere in the mountains above, often sat at altitudes above 5,000 feet. Virtually the whole state of Wyoming, for example, lies at an altitude of 6,000 feet or higher, Much of Colorado is over a mile high. Most of Utah is over 4,000 feet. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, the frost-free season is barely 4 months. In such a climate, one can grow only low-value crops, alfalfa, irrigated pasture, wheat, which require much acreage to produce a meager income. Not only that, but some such crops, irrigated pasture in particular, require a lot of water, up to 3 times more than some high-value crops, oranges, tomatoes, nuts, even lettuce. In 1915, it made sense to build a few economically ill-advised projects in the interior West anyway, in order to reduce its abject reliance on imported food and offer some economic stability to the region. And in fact, dozens of marginal projects were built in the Rocky Mountain and Northern Plains states during the first 30 years of Reclamation's reign. But it began to make less and less sense by 1945, after tens of billions of dollars had been invested in an efficient transportation system that forever ended the isolation of places like Cheyenne and helped bring them into the nation's economic mainstream. And it made even less sense by 1955, when the nation was burying itself under mountains of surplus crops, often the same crops, wheat, barley, corn, that had to be grown in the high, cold intermountain West. What all of this meant, to the taxpayers anyway, was that the overwhelming share of the cost of any so-called self-financing project in the Upper Colorado Basin would end up being subsidized by them. The cost of the projects would be so great, the value of the crops so low, and the irrigators' ability to pay for water so pitiful, that to demand that they repay the taxpayers' investment in 40 years, even allowing for the exemption from interest payments, would be to lead them into certain bankruptcy. Some of the older, better projects had already had some of their repayments contracts sneakily extended by several decades, and there was absolutely no evidence that they could be repaid even then. But on the other hand, to imagine Congress booting farmers off reclamation projects because they couldn't meet their payment obligations was unthinkable. The taxpayers would have to bail them out, even if bailing them out meant a long-term bill of billions and billions of dollars. How well the Bureau's leadership understood this is a good question, although the secret correspondence in the Bureau's files reveals that they knew a lot more than they let on in public. In the 1920s, Frederick Newell, the former Reclamation Commissioner, was already decrying the sentimentality of the federal irrigation program, through which, he said, money was deftly taken from the pockets of the taxpayers. What is true, of course, does not necessarily matter in a political sense, and that was particularly the case in the American West and even more so in the Upper Basin. By the 1950s, California was already using its full 4.4 million acre-foot entitlement to the Colorado River and planning batteries of new pumps that will allow it to suck up 700,000 acre-feet of additional flows. The Bureau, having built Hoover Dam mainly for California's benefit, was now embarking on the Central Valley Project, a project of absolutely breathtaking scope that was exclusively for California. As far as the Upper Basin was concerned, it was time for some equity. And equity was only the half of it. If there were surplus water in the river, water which the Upper Basin owned but wasn't yet able to use, and California began borrowing it, would that imperial-minded state deign to give it back? The imperative for the Upper Basin was to develop its share of the Colorado River as fast as possible, whether the projects that could be built there made sense or not. And it was the basin's unbelievably good fortune that in the 1940s, Congress would give it a money-making machine that would allow it to do so, a machine that became known as the cash register dam. A cash register dam was to be a dam with an overriding, if not a single, purpose, to generate electricity for commercial sales. The electricity would bring in many millions of dollars in annual revenues, which could be used to subsidize irrigation projects that hadn't a prayer of paying back the taxpayers' investment. The dams were an invention spawned by something the Bureau of Reclamation called River Basin Accounting, which was itself spawned by something it called River Basin Planning. River Basin Planning, at least, made a certain amount of sense. A river like the Arkansas, which rises in the Colorado Rockies and empties into the Mississippi in an utterly different time zone and topography and climate, invites competing and potentially incompatible uses. Upstream, it is valuable for irrigation. Downstream, it is valuable for inland navigation. If the Bureau diverts too much water for upstream irrigation, there won't be enough water available downstream to justify the Army Corps of Engineers' efforts to turn the lower river into a freeway for barges, an obsession it has been pursuing on virtually every large river in the country. The dilemma could also work in reverse. If the Corps got a head start on the lower sections of a river, the Bureau could find itself unable to get any upriver projects authorized. The creation of the Tennessee Valley Authority marked the first time a major river system was viewed whole, even if the natural river virtually disappeared as a result. The TVA was regarded as such a success by the administration of Franklin Roosevelt that it began to demand, if not more quasi-dictatorial authorities like the TVA, then at least a coordinated plan of development between the Bureau and the Corps. This was river basin planning. And, except for the fact that no one ever spent more than a minute or two thinking about the value of a river in its natural state, it made some degree of sense. River basin accounting was a horse of a different color, though the Bureau developed a propensity to use planning and accounting interchangeably. With river basin accounting, one could take all the revenues generated by projects in any river basin, dams, irrigation projects, navigation and recreation features, and toss them into a common fund. The hydroelectric dams might contribute 95 cents of every dollar accruing to the fund, while the irrigation features might contribute only a nickel, and cost three times as much to build and operate as the dams, but it wouldn't matter. As long as the revenues came in at a pace that would permit the Reclamation Acres 40-year repayment schedule to be met, the whole package could be considered economically sound. It was as if a conglomerate purchased a dozen money-losing subsidiaries while operating a highly profitable silver mine, a case of horribly bad management which, nonetheless, still leaves the company barely in the black. Michael Robinson, the Bureau's semi-official historian, exhibits no compunction about admitting any of this in the Bureau's authorized history, Water for the West. By the late 1930s, the high cost of projects made it increasingly difficult for reclamation engineers to meet economic feasibility requirements. In the early 1940s, the Bureau devised the plan of considering an entire river basin as an integrated project. It enabled the agency to derive income from various revenue-producing subfeatures, notably power facilities, to fund other works not economically feasible under reclamation law. Thus, by offsetting construction and development costs against pooled revenues, the Bureau was able to demonstrate the economic feasibility for the entire pooled program. In 1942, this method was used for the first time in planning a basin-wide development program for the Bighorn River in Wyoming. All benefits and income from producing units were lumped together to establish overall feasibility. In 1944, the Bureau's Sloan plan for the development of the Missouri River followed the same formula and encouraged the Bureau to enthusiastically prepare basin-wide plans for several western rivers. Enthusiastically is a bit of an understatement. The beauty of river basin accounting, from the Bureau's point of view, was that it would be literally forced to build dams. The engineering mentality, which Robinson himself admits, came to dominate the Bureau's thinking in the 1930s and 1940s, created an institutional distaste for irrigation projects. They were a necessary nuisance that provided the rationale for what Bureau men really love to do, build majestic dams. In the past, however, the infeasibility of many projects put a damper on their ambitions because if a project didn't make economic sense, they lost the rationale they needed to build a dam to store water. With river basin accounting, the equation was stood on its head. A lot of bad projects, economically infeasible ones, created a rationale for building more, not fewer, dams. The dams, all with hydroelectric features, of course, would be required to compensate for the financial losses of the irrigation projects. The losses would miraculously vanish in the common pool of revenues. River Basin accounting, then, was a perversion of a sensible idea, that idea being to plan the orderly, a favorite Bureau word, development of a river basin from headwaters to mouth. But even if it subverted logic, economics, and simple common sense, it was essential to the Bureau's survival as an institution and to the continued expansion of irrigation in the high, arid West. On the other hand, it was something akin to a blanket death sentence for the free-flowing rivers in 16 states. What the upper basin of the Colorado lacked, because of its elevation, in feasible irrigation projects is more than made up, for the same reason, in sites for cash register dams. High and mountainous, geologically young, the basin had deep valleys and tight, plunging gorges ideal for dams, gorges in which ran rivers that fed the main Colorado and could be included, under the bizarre new logic of river basin accounting, in any grand basin-wide scheme. The rivers, draining arid and semi-arid regions, may not have held much runoff, but a very high dam on a small river can yield as much hydroelectricity as a low dam on a much larger one. That is the beauty of what dam engineers called hydrologic head. Velocity of falling water does the work of volume, of mass. There was Glen Canyon on the main stem Colorado, Powell's favorite riverine haunt, an ideal site for a 600-foot dam. There was Flaming Gorge on the Green and Red Canyon, each a perfect site for a gigantic, curved-arch, thin-wall dam approaching Hoover in size. There was the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, an almost sheer 1,000-foot gorge with several sites for high dams. The Dolores, the Yampa, the White, even smaller streams like the Animas and San Miguel and Little Snake, each had at least one site for a cash register dam. Since the dams would have to be large compared to the meager river flows, they would be expensive to build. But that wouldn't matter. The Bureau had the treasury at its disposal. All the upper basin needed, then, was congressional clout. That and a reclamation commissioner who believed in dams for dams' sake. And it was the upper basin's further good fortune that, near the end of his third term, Franklin Roosevelt would appoint such a man as his commissioner of reclamation. His name was Michael Strauss. Mike Strauss was the unlikeliest commissioner the Bureau ever had. For one thing, he was an Easterner. For another, he was a newspaper man. On top of that, he was rich. By temperament, Strauss was an exact opposite of the slide-rule engineers who had guided the Bureau during its 40-odd years. He was an anomaly down to his very genes. Strauss had married into the Dodge family, and his brother-in-law was Elliot Porter. He had wealth and social connections, too. While typical Bureau of Reclamation families spent their vacations on houseboats cruising the reservoirs that Daddy built, Strauss went to the family retreat at Spruce Head Island on Maine's Penobscot Bay. It was their island, all of it. Strauss could have spent his life clipping coupons, safari hunting, or writing the hyperventilating prose that was his second love. But there was nothing on earth that gave Mike Strauss quite as much boyish, exuberant satisfaction as erecting dams. In 8 years as Commissioner of Reclamation, he would become responsible for as many water projects as any person who ever lived. Strauss had been selected at the close of the war by Harold Ickes, himself a newspaper man, after the Roosevelt administration had endured 12 years of relatively plodding Bureau leadership under Elwood Meade, Harry Bashore, and John Page. Strauss was Ickes' alter ego, a newspaper man, a liberal, a fighter, a curmudgeon. Franklin Roosevelt, who equated wealth with energy and idealism, heartily endorsed the appointment. It was a brilliant stroke. For all his man-of-the-people reputation, FDR felt paranoia about the common man. His secret fear was that the Depression would begin anew after the war, and the returning veterans would be unable to find jobs. Ultimately, they might revolt. In the Bureau of